الندم ولم تهني وذت في الله لم تهزم.
This is PII Live from Africa.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to another edition of the French Connection. Today's date is the 31st day of October, 2008, a Friday. Of course, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Daryl Bradford Smith, coming to you directly, live and direct from France. It's great to be here with you this evening for this most important of broadcasts. Lots of things to discuss with you in this upcoming hour. I'm glad to be back with you here on the network. I hope everybody is well. If you have been following your news reports, you are getting at least a touch of the truth. I'm sure a little bit of what is actually happening in this world is trickling down to you through your news reports. Things are hotting up all over the globe. Intentionally, ladies and gentlemen, there are problems financially that are beginning to find themselves into the real economy, meaning the production economy, the mom-and-pop small store, little, the small business community are all feeling the heat. Bankruptcies and the problems in business are all tripling and quadrupling in numbers. We are in the midst of one of the worst contractions in memory, and certainly with the potential of becoming one of the worst in human history. This situation that is starting to inflame the globe, if you'll allow that analogy, what's happening, ladies and gentlemen, is the banks have taken all the credit away from small companies to do their business, but yet they were filled with monies from the government coffers across the Western world. So they're sitting on piles of cash. These banks, they're waiting for things to become desperately cheap, housing to become desperately cheap, businesses to become desperately cheap, and then they will open up their money and start buying businesses for pennies on the dollar or pennies on the rand or pennies on the French franc, I mean the Swiss franc or wherever you are, the pound. So, but who's doing this to us? And I hear a lot of things, and I applaud Inayat Wadi's programming. It was a harrowing experience for the gentlemen that were taken into custody and then abused for their faith in Uganda. And the fact is, ladies and gentlemen, Uganda has been a Israeli stronghold for actually a half a century. In fact, the raid on Entebbe was an entirely staged event. All of the things that happened in that raid that they showed you, they've made a movie out of it, were fabrications. And the fact that is that Idi Amin was placed into power as a strongman there by intelligence forces in Israel and in America. And they've never relinquished their control there, and of course they want to stir up the flames of racism and hatred toward other religions in Uganda to keep the public there blind to the truth. But, you know, the truth is this, and it's simple. Good and righteous, kind, loving people on this globe, on this planet, are starting to understand who the enemy is, who the true enemy is, who the persons or people are by name, who the groups are by name, who the organizations are, the businesses are by their name. They're beginning to understand that we are in a fight for our very survival. And that survival depends largely, in my view, on our ability to attract righteous people, kind people, caring people, family people, to this message and sharing it amongst their friends and their relatives and their business associates and their community leaders and their police departments, because the police have been acting on behalf of these criminals for so long, they truly need to be re-educated, and that is a major challenge that we all face. Tonight I'm going to bring up somebody who has been a longtime collaborator with me. In fact, we are one of the few of two people in the world who've ever been they requested us to be banned by the government in South Africa. I've been several times now, had letters sent, they want me banned off this radio station. Jacob Zaki, James Dickey, my friend, has also experienced the censorship in the South African market. So we have that as certainly in common. The other thing we have in common, ladies and gentlemen, is a sincere hope that that the rest of humanity can start understanding who our true foes are and the true criminals are, and that we might be able to spread that information so more people can stand shoulder to shoulder in opposition to these criminals. So I'm going to bring them up right now. Yaakov Zaki, are you with me?
Yes, I'm here, Dal.
It is great to have you, James, Dickie, Yaakov Zaki. It is wonderful. Again, you know, we always do such a lively and informative program together, and that is why I've invited you back on. You know, one of the things that they're trying to do right now in many markets of the world, many places of the world, and it's standard stuff for these people, is whip up hatred between the races. We're seeing it in America terrible right now between blacks and whites. We're seeing it between Latinos and whites and Latinos and blacks. But we're also seeing it against Islam here in Europe, against the white community. And people are coming out saying, I'm white and I'm proud and la, la, la. They're trying to stir these flames of derision and hatred. And in fact, people left on their to their own devices don't feel this way, James. You want to elaborate on that?
Well, Darrell, first of all, let me say I think you've missed the significance of the date. Tonight is Halloween, All Hallows
Eve. Yes, All Hallows Eve, that's right,
in
yes.
Which satanic forces stalk the earth, released from Hades, to torment humankind. So the date is significant, don't you think? Because there is a specter that's stalking the world at the moment. It's not just the specter of bankruptcy, but the specter of world dominion, of a Hebraic hegemony controlling the entire world through through banking deficit.
That is exactly true. But they work on a lot of levels, don't they, James? I mean, these people are very thorough in their planning. They've got organizations to stir up hatred in the black community. They've got organizations to stir up hatred in the white community, in the homosexual community. In every community you can possibly divide a human family into, they are stirring up trouble between the groups and using the division between our groups to keep us away from each other so we can never, ever come together to fight them.
To unite against the common enemy. Well, we see that very clearly in Britain.
Yes.
A few weeks ago, attending a meeting of the New Right, I was attacked, not physically, but verbally abused, by a member of the BNP, the British National Party. Now, I think the BNP is being controlled by these sinister forces. This Welshman who's in charge of it, he's a cynical opportunist. And he, because since 7-7, the Muslims are unpopular in this country, and in fact, 7-7 bears all the fruit of 9/11, and we know who was behind that, don't we?
Yes,
because
yes, we do.
It's a question of quis custodiet, who stands to profit, and the American military industrial base has made a fortune out of the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan, and now they are pillaging the national resources of Iraq. However, to get back to the BNP, you see they are diverting the attention of right-wing elements in Britain, embodied in the BNP, away from the Zionists and the Freemasons and all these other sinister semi-occult groups that work from the shadows, and so as to focus their hatred on the Muslims.
Yes. Well, I've always said, and I think we talked about this last time you were with me, the goal has been, and I'm going to give you a little vignette here, and maybe you can give me your critique or your approval. Back in the 1970s, each country in Europe invited in a different group of Muslims from Africa to come and live and work in their countries. Now, the French brought in Algerians, and the British brought in Pakistanis, and the Spanish brought in Moroccans, and of course the Germans brought in Turks. And what we had is every country had their own Islamic minority. What they've done is they've marginalized that minority. They've inflicted poverty upon that minority. They've allowed those minorities to become riddled with crime and drugs. And then they have inflamed that minority and caused it to be in opposition to the society they're in. And then they are saying that this is because we should hate Islam, we should hate the Muslims, And by that declaration, we should be fighting Islam wherever they are. And they're using this as a very well-planned conspiracy, in my view, James.
It's a diversionary tactic.
Yes.
To divert people away from the parties who are really responsible for the world.
Exactly. And they want to start a war between Islam and Christianity so that we can fight ourselves out to death. And who left standing but the criminal Zionists?
We know this from George W. Bush himself. And notice
yes.
how they always refer to Bush on the radio as George W. Bush. I don't know why they give him this initial. Maybe it's to give him some substance that he otherwise lacks. Because it's still a mystery to me, as an ex-visiting professor at Harvard, how a man like that could possibly graduate from an East Coast university. A university that's a member of the Ivy League. However, he, in one of his more indiscreet moments, and I mean, we have to admit he's not very much up top, has he? Referred to this war as a crusade, and then he was advised by his advisors not to use that term because it's got certain historical resonances. But of course, it is a crusade. Except
well,
this time, it's a crusade that's not led by the cross, by the symbol of crucifixion and man's redemption. It's a crusade in which the banner has the inverted triangles of Judaism.
That's right. The Star of David is behind this. The
exactly.
Shield of Rothschild.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the Star
no.
of David. The Shield of David. Because
well,
it's
the Star of David
as well as an esoteric one. Hmm?
Yes. Now, the Star of David is actually the adopted seal of the Rothschild fortune, and so is the color red. But, you know...
Oh, it's King Solomon. I see. Yeah, I didn't know that that was the insignia of the House of Rothschild.
Well, it is, and the fact of the matter is, now, what we face today, as you well know, in the West, at least, is a demonization of Islam. And of course it's been successful because the press is owned and operated by the criminal forces. So we almost have no voice in trying to set records straight when we hear a lie or we hear an exaggeration or we hear something that should be corrected. Our voice is minuscule compared to the criminals that are standing in control of all these great powerful media organizations. So. Most
of these immense corporations and press barons like Rupert Murdoch for Murdoch Reed Mordecai. You can decode
right.
these names easily. Who's got it in for Prince Charles? Because Prince Charles is rumored to be pro-Palestinian.
Well, you know, what we can face right now, here's the interesting thing we face today. The world right now is heading toward a complete collapse financially. Now, it's going to touch everybody, in, whether they're in Islam or they're not. But the fact of the matter is that because usury has been kept out of the villages and hamlets of many of the Islamic countries, they will not be as injured as many parts of the West will. I'm watching today forces, very powerful forces, are working very quickly to consolidate their control financially over the entire planet.
Well, I don't know. I agree with you there, Darrow. I mean, ever since the occupation of the Muslim world by the colonial forces in the 19th century, these countries have been converted into capitalist economies controlled by the banks. And remember, it was the introduction of Western banking in the Ottoman Empire that brought about the collapse of Ottoman industry.
That's right. That's right. The bust boom cycle was inflicted, and they had a bust, and the entire place went under. And then the Young Turks used that opportunity to undermine everything in that society. And you're exactly right, James. I want to go on to something here that I've been listening to on American stations for a long time, and that is the bad guys are always the German death cult, or they're the Illuminati, or they are the Freemasons, or they are the Black Pope. What they fail to say when they do this is that behind
the
all these organizations...
The head of the Jesuit order.
Was a Jew.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, even Ignatius Loyola, we believe, was of Hebrew descent.
That's right. That's right. Now, my point is this. behind all these organizations and who formed them and who were the brainchild of them and who financed them and who gave them the lubrication they needed to become stronger and larger. And you can go on to these other organizations like the CFR that came after, the Roundtable that came after. What you see in every instance is a Warburg or a Rothschild or a powerful Jewish family in Oppenheimer or in the early days. Now you see families like Brockman,
you're invited
and you see
to
the
live
Solomon
where
brothers,
began,
you see a Goldman,
white city
you see Mendelssohn.
Never said it,
you can't look anywhere in this world without seeing a powerful Zionist, criminal Jew behind the pushing forward of these organizations and their agenda. You want to talk a little bit about the origins of the Illuminati, for example?
Well, you know, this is a subject that's much debated amongst historians. The other day I was reading Nesta Webster, you know, Secret Societies and Subversive Movements,
yes,
which is a classic of its kind. And she said that the Illuminati preceded Adam Weishaupt.
That's right.
Is she correct?
Yes, I believe she was, yep.
Uh-huh.
In other words, you can see the roots of this bohemian, Polish, ghettoized Jewish Zionist group that wasn't called Zionism at the time.
The mentality of the modern Jew was formed in the ghetto. And then when, under the influence of the European Enlightenment in the 18th century, which began to influence Jewish intellectual circles like Moses Mendelssohn and set in motion the Jewish Enlightenment, the Halacha, when they come out of the ghettos, they proceed to take over the non-ghettos.
That's exactly right. And you have famous actors in this crime gang, such as, of course, Lenin, which is Vladimir Lenin was not his real name. He was Jewish. And, of course, we have Trotsky, which is not his name. He was Jewish. And you have people like Sigmund Freud, who was another Jew. And then you can take it all the way deeper and farther back and go into Jacob Frank and the Frankist movement and the New Bohemian movement and the Sabbatean movement that gave birth to all of these.
Well, this interests me very much because I consider myself something of a specialist in Ottoman history.
Yes.
You know, this man had a very short life. I think he only lived to the age of 43. Let me glance at his dates. He was born in 1726 and died in 1769. So what's that?
Yeah,
47.
Who?
Sabbatai Zevi.
Yes, and now, but the fact is they claim that he was the Messiah of these Jews, these criminals.
Yeah.
He claimed he was.
He converted or nominally embraced Islam in 1666 at the hands of Mehmet IV. But the one who advised him to convert to Islam was the Sultan's private physician, who was a Jew, converted, who had himself converted. But even after Sabbatai Zevi's conversion, which I don't think was genuine, he played a double game. He was really a double agent. Sometimes he would put on the turban. He would preach to Muslims on the iniquity of the Jews, and other times he would go into synagogues, address the Jews, and preach to them on the iniquity of the Muslims. But what really caused the trouble in the Ottoman Empire was, you see,
gave birth to the concept of crypto Judaism.
Oh yeah, but that comes later, or rather earlier, because crypto Judaism was born in Spain.
That's right.
It was a formula for survival. And in fact, a great Jewish friend of mine, now deceased, Professor Sanford Schiffer of Oberlin College in Ohio, he contended that the picaresque genre in Spanish literature was entirely a Jewish monopoly. And what it is, it's code. These picaresque novels employ coded language whereby crypto-Jews could communicate with each other without Christians realizing what was going on.
Well, what we see today now, what we see this group, what we see the genesis of this group coming through the Frankists, which was the group that took over from Sabbatai Zevi after his death. And the Frankist movement, it moved around in the northern part of Europe throughout the ghettos, And what we see is that there was a strengthening of their power in the hands of the leadership of these communities. And one of them, of course, was Oppenheimer, and the other was Rothschild. But you see them involved in one of the things I'd like to bring forward here, and you maybe agree or disagree. During the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages, many of these Jews were not permitted to be landholders and landowners. And so what they did was they were allowed to be merchants because they were kept out of the rights of the guilds. They couldn't be in the guilds, and they couldn't be involved in the
state. That's right, because the guilds had a Catholic and theological basis.
That's right. Now, what happened...
As in Islam, yes? Uh-huh.
That's right. Now, what happened was, because they became very astute merchants between different areas of Europe, they were able to strengthen themselves, and when the Dark Ages came to a close, they were strengthened by pots of money used as parts of... They were trading between big markets, making lots of money, strengthening their mercantile and their mercantilist leanings, and became very powerful and wealthy. And they used this money to strengthen their control over their own community and gave themselves even larger riches, which they in turn used to start gold dealing and bullion dealing. And these people actually built themselves up from their beginnings to a very powerful force. And
they ultimately controlled the kings, Darrell, although through Freemasonry, they tried ultimately to abolish the concept of to banish monarchy from the shores of Europe. But you see, here in Europe, we've got two big problems that maybe you don't have to the same degree in America. One is dynastic ambitions, because we have monarchy, not one monarchy, but we had scores. And the other is pressure and space, because Europe is a very small continent. It's really just a peninsula of Asia. It's densely populated. Now, this pressure and space combined with dynastic ambitions meant that Europe was a theater of warfare for centuries. Ever since the collapse of the Pax Romana, when for 400 years Europe had enjoyed unbroken peace, there's been nothing but warfare, and perhaps in the 20th century more wars and more destructive wars than in all the preceding 15 centuries. Now, to prosecute wars, because war is very expensive, you need loans. So the kings would go to the Jewish bankers to finance the wars, and that put them in hock to the Jews.
That's right. And there's another thing that people don't know, that in 1827, and you said something about this today, and it's in the Synagogue of Satan, the book that Andrew Carrington Hitchcock wrote, the Catholic Church turned over its financial dealings to the hands of the Rothschild bankers. And the bankers, the Rothschild bankers became the de facto controllers of the Catholic fortunes worldwide. And they have remained so until this day. So my point is to you, he who holds the purse strings holds the power, if you will allow that.
Yes, well, you know, I've always looked on the Vatican as a very cynical organization. As a Scotsman, I was disgusted by their abandoning the Stuarts. They were the Stuarts who lost the throne in this country on account of their fidelity to the Church. But was the Church faithful to them? Not a bit. After the death of James VIII, the Vatican didn't recognize the Stuart succession in this country. But you see, really, monarchy departed these shores with James the Seventh. Or in England he would be James the Second. In came the bankers from Holland, because Holland was the first capitalist country and England was the second. Now, capital depends on banking, and banking by that time was being manipulated by the Jews. So you have the foundation of the Bank of England in 1694, and from that point onward it takes off. Not only in England, but Holland, in all the Protestant countries, this dynamism that is the inevitable accompaniment of capitalism meant that their economies prospered. It wasn't the ordinary people were any better off. If anything, they were worse under capitalism. But the certain classes became exceedingly rich. Now, as we know, the Catholic Church banned usury right down to 1830. Why did it cynically drop the ban on usury then? Well, you've given me the answer. 1827. The Rothschilds take over as as God's bankers, the bankers of for the Vatican.
Okay.
And they the Catholic Church, seeing the industrial progress of the Protestant nations and how the Catholic nations were lagging behind, they cynically lifted the ban on usury, just as Pope John Paul II a few years ago cynically lifted the ban on Freemasonry. And with that,
see
the final eclipse of the authority of the Catholic Church.
I'm
not going to the church any longer. I mean, as you know, I was educated in Spain, at Barcelona and Granada universities. In my time, everybody attended Mass. Nowadays, it's only 40% of Spain, supposedly the most Catholic country in Europe.
Well, I'm mistaken. I have the book open. It was 1823, the Rothschilds take over financial operations.
The 7 years between the Rothschild takeover of the finances of the Catholic Church and the cancellation of the ban on usury.
That's right. That's right. And
so that's
at the same
time, if you have the Rothschilds who are usurers operating a usurious system of banking, naturally you can't maintain your ban on usury, can you?
Nope. And you know what else that happened in 1830 was when David Sassoon was working the East India Company to go to war in China and sell opium. So what we know is that the Jews were very active in that period, consolidating their power, and you know as well as I do, they were marrying into some of these poverty-stricken, gentrified landowners in Britain who had no money, but they had lots of land, and they had titles. And a lot of the titles have turned into Jewish-controlled lordships, have they not?
Well, the Rothschilds intermarried the aristocracy. I know this from my own experience. I was at school with Alfie Primrose. Now, you know, when you're that age, about 12 or so, you know nothing about genealogy. But, I mean, nothing can... only the association of pain can sharpen your memory. As Dr. Johnson says, it concentrates a man's mind wonderfully when he knows he's going to be hanged in 10 days' time. And he was speaking from experience, if not his own personal experience, at least that of his uncle who was hanged. Now, you see, in Scotland, we don't have the cane the way you have in English schools. I mean, that's far too sexy for Presbyterian Scotland. So it's the Tors. Like, Alfie Primrose was my school chum. And I can always remember, you know, when we were misbehaving, because boys of that age, we never ceased to misbehave. We were called out to the floor for punishment. As the teacher would take the strap out from his desk, he would say, "From you, Dickie," referring to me, "I would expect anything. But you, Primrose, belong to one of the leading families of Scotland. Do you behave like this at home?" Followed by wallop, wallop, wallop. And then we'd be sent back to our seats holding back our tears. Now, it never occurred to me that my friend Alfie was the grandson, or maybe the great-grandson, of Lord Rosebery, who